This is Steve Carroll, and you're listening to the EM Basic Podcast. In this episode, we're going to talk about syncope. This is something that we deal with a lot, and while most causes of syncope aren't anything to worry about, we need to find those people who have potentially serious causes of syncope or passing out. For a bonus section, at the request of a listener, we'll talk a little bit about how to rehydrate patients in the ED. As always, this podcast doesn't represent the views or opinions of the Department of Defense, the U.S. Army, or the Shawshank Emergency Medicine Residency. As always, pay attention to the vital signs on the chart. Hypotension or tachycardia can be worrisome signs in a patient with syncope. Before we talk about how to take the all-important history, we need to talk about the definition of syncope. Syncope is defined as a rapid loss of consciousness followed by a rapid return to baseline. The biggest mistake that we make here is the rapid return to baseline part. If the patient doesn't wake up immediately after they pass out, then it's not syncope, and it needs to be investigated in a much different manner. Also, if the patient has any other symptoms like chest pain, headache, or seizure activity, then this needs to be investigated in a much different manner. To illustrate this point, I'll actually use myself as an example. A few years ago, I passed out on a flight. Before I left that morning for the flight, I worked out at the gym and ate a large lunch of Mexican food before I got on the plane. No alcohol, I swear. I fell asleep on the plane with the sun shining directly through the window, and when I woke up, I felt awful. I felt hot and flushed, I felt nauseous and dizzy, I honestly have never felt so awful my entire life. I got up to go to the bathroom in the back of the plane, and made it about 3 steps before I just crumpled into the aisleway. I woke up a few seconds later to panic passengers, and the first thing I thought was, wow, I feel so much better. I woke up right away and sat up and felt a lot better. The flight attendants got me a bunch of water to drink, and over the course of the next hour, I think I had about 1/2 gallon of water to drink. When I put it all together, the combination of working out, not drinking enough water, and a large salty meal before the flight, while sitting asleep in direct sunlight, dehydrated me to the point where I syncopized from the dehydration. The important thing was that I had an identified stressor, I passed out suddenly, and returned to consciousness quickly. So here's the physiology behind syncope. As always, I promise this will be quick. When you think about it, syncope is a sudden loss of blood flow to your brain. If you're talking about pure syncope, then the organ we need to worry about the most is the heart. I know this is super obvious, but your heart is what pumps blood to your brain. The most common cause of syncope is vasovagal, meaning that some stressor caused increased vagal tone that causes bradycardia and hypotension, and this causes you to pass out and reset everything. So let's talk about how to take a good history in patients with syncope. The first thing to identify is that this is really syncope. Often people will say that they are weak and dizzy, but they really mean syncope or near syncope. It's important that we differentiate between dizziness and syncope. Dizziness is a sensation of the room spinning, or disequilibrium, and is a much different workup. When we talk about syncope, we are talking about actually passing out or feeling lightheaded to the point where you're going to pass out. Some people argue that near syncope and full-blown syncope are different workups, but they aren't. Usually what happens when a patient almost passes out is that they sit down or support themselves on something to prevent from passing out. Near syncope is still the same workup as full-blown syncope. They just didn't go all the way to ground. So clarify with the patient whether this was dizziness, lightheadedness, or full-blown syncope. If the patient says they felt dizzy, I always ask the patient, did it feel like the room was spinning, or did you feel like you were going to pass out? If you don't ask this question, then you may go down the wrong diagnostic path and work up dizziness when you should really be working up syncope. So start by asking the patient to describe in their own words what happened. Once you've clarified that this was near syncope or syncope, ask about any stressors prior to the episode. Was there any emotional distress, temperature changes, painful conditions, dehydration, or insufficient food intake? Also ask about any preceding symptoms before the syncope. Ask the patient if they felt hot or flushed, if they had tingling in their extremities, or if they had any nausea. If anyone witnessed the episode, ask them what they saw. Ask them if the patient hit their head, and you'll want to also ask them about any seizure activity and about how long it took the patient to wake up and return to normal. If the patient was out for 30 seconds, that's fine. About a minute or longer, and we start to worry about other conditions. Some people may report myoclonic jerking while the patient was passed out. If it's just a few jerks of the extremities, then that is not as worrisome as sustained tonic-clonic movements where the patient shakes all their extremities for an extended amount of time. The other part of the history is whether or not the patient woke up right away. If the patient is confused or not waking up right away, then this can suggest that the patient had a seizure. In fact, for you to diagnose a seizure, there has to be a period of altered mental status or confusion called the postictal period. The patient has to wake up right away for this to be syncope. If they didn't, then this is not syncope by definition. The final thing to ask is whether the syncope occurred during exercise. This can suggest an arrhythmia or hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. The next thing to address is any preceding symptoms to the syncope. These can suggest a different serious cause to the syncope that needs to be addressed in a different manner. Syncope plus a headache can be a subarachnoid hemorrhage. Syncope with a neurological deficit can be a stroke, TIA, or intracranial bleed. Syncope with confusion after the event can be a seizure. Syncope with chest pain can be an MI, a pulmonary embolism, or an aortic dissection. Syncope with back pain or abdominal pain in an older patient can be a ruptured AAA. And finally, syncope with a positive HCG can be a ruptured ectopic pregnancy. So be sure to do a complete review of systems to make sure that there are no red flags with the syncope that could suggest an alternate diagnosis. Finally, get a good past medical history on the patient. The first thing to address is to make sure that this isn't recurrent syncope. If a patient is young with a known stressor, and this is the first time they have ever passed out, I'm not very worried. However, if someone tells me that they are passing out a lot and can't figure out why, then this is very worrisome. Ask specifically for any history of seizures, diabetes, stroke or TIA, MI, or a known AAA. In younger patients, I ask about any family history of heart disease, but then I ask a much more important question. I want to know if they have any family history of sudden cardiac death. Now, if you just go up to a patient and ask them whether or not anyone has died suddenly at a young age in their family, then this is going to freak them out because they think it's going to happen to them. In order to not freak out the patient, what I say is, I'm not saying that this is going to happen to you, but has anyone in your family died suddenly at a young age and they didn't find out why? If they have a blood relative with sudden cardiac death, then they may need a more aggressive workup. We'll talk more about sudden cardiac death in a little while. Let's review the history one more time. First, clarify that this was true syncope, which is a rapid loss of consciousness followed by a rapid return to baseline. Make sure that the patient returned to baseline quickly. If they were confused or it took a long time to wake up, then this suggests a seizure. Near syncope should be treated the same as actual syncope. Dizziness or having a sensation of disequilibrium or room spinning is a different workup. Make sure that the patient isn't having frequent or recurrent syncope and ask if there are any blood relatives with a history of sudden cardiac death. Be sure to screen for red flags such as chest pain, neurological deficit, confusion after waking up, headache, back or abdominal pain, or positive HCG, along with the syncope that could suggest a more serious cause. Now let's talk about a good physical exam for patients with the syncope. You'll want to check the patients for any signs of head trauma and make sure to do a good neuro exam. Next, check the heart for any murmurs. In a young patient with syncope, especially if they passed out during exercise or shortly thereafter, I take the extra step of listening for murmurs while they are bearing down and again while they are squatting. I know that this may look weird to be squatting down next to the patient, but you want to make sure to accentuate any murmurs that could be causing a life-threatening arrhythmia. Finally, do a full head-to-toe exam and make sure to check for back or abdominal tenderness. Now let's talk about the differential diagnosis of syncope. We just went through some of these, but let's go over the whole list to get the big picture. The causes for syncope is a list about a mile long, but let's go over the important causes of syncope that we can't miss. I'll go over the list of causes first, then go over each one, and a quick review of the signs and symptoms that should make you suspicious. Now obviously this isn't meant to be a complete review of each of these possible diagnoses, just a few things that should trigger your memory to avoid missing serious causes of syncope. So let's go over the list as a whole, then we'll go through each one individually. Differential diagnosis includes seizure, subarachnoid hemorrhage or intracranial hemorrhage, ruptured AAA, GI bleed, MI, aortic dissection, aortic stenosis, pulmonary embolism, stroke or TIA, arrhythmia, carotid sinus sensitivity, orthostatic hypotension, hypoglycemia, toxicologic, and sepsis. So let's go through all these one at a time. So seizure, think of this in a patient who has generalized tonic-clonic movements with their eyes open. They must have a period of confusion after the seizure called a postictal period. Subarachnoid hemorrhage or intracranial hemorrhage, So if they think of this in a patient with a seizure plus a headache or a neurological deficit, especially if the headache preceded the syncope. Ruptured AAA. So this is an older patient with a history of hypertension, with back pain or abdominal pain, possibly hematuria, with or without unstable vital signs. In these patients, you want to get stat bedside ultrasound if you suspect the diagnosis. GI bleed. So think of this in a patient with syncope who has bloody or black stools. MI. Think of this diagnosis if the patient has chest pain and syncope. You'll want to get your EKG and go down your chest pain workup there. Aortic dissection. So this is a patient classically with ripping or tearing chest pain or back pain, possibly with a pulse or neurological deficit that goes along with it. Aortic stenosis. So think of this in an older patient with a systolic ejection murmur that radiates into the carotids. Pulmonary embolism. You'll want to think of this diagnosis in patients with a sudden onset of shortness of breath or pleuritic chest pain, or with patients who have risk factors for a PE. Stroke or TIA. Once again, you'll think of this in a patient with syncope who has a neurological deficit. Arrhythmia, so we'll talk more about this in a minute. Carotid sinus sensitivity. So if the patient has recurrent syncope while doing things like shaving, checking their carotid pulse, or tying a necktie, then they may be having a hypersensitive carotid sinus that causes bradycardia when the patient puts pressure on it. Orthostatic hypotension. This can be caused by medications like alpha blockers or beta blockers, or if the patient is dehydrated. Hypoglycemia. So you want to think of this in a patient who is diabetic or if they ingested a diabetic medication. Tox causes. So this can encompass drugs, alcohol, or environmental causes like carbon monoxide poisoning. If the patient has a toxidrome on exam, then this needs to be investigated further. And finally, sepsis. So if the patient has fever and signs of infection, then these can be signs of sepsis and this should be further worked up. Now let's talk about the workup in syncope. When you're starting out, the temptation is to order large workups on these patients, but if you take a good history, you can limit yourself to a small workup in the majority of patients. Let's go back to the definition of syncope, a rapid loss of consciousness followed by a rapid return to baseline. When you think about this, the cardiac system is what we need to be worrying about the most, especially an arrhythmia. Something caused the patient's heart to pump insufficient blood to the brain, so we need to pay special attention to the cardiac system. In the episode on chest pain, I said that everyone with chest pain needs only two things, an EKG and a chest x-ray, and anything further is dictated by the history of their present illness. The same thing is true with syncope. Every patient needs an EKG, and females of childbearing age need an HCG. That's it. That's not to say that we don't order more tests on some people. It's just saying that every person with syncope must have an EKG, and young females must have a urine HCG. Beyond that, further workup is guided by the patient's history, physical exam, and presence of red flags. I stress all this because when you're starting out, the temptation is to shotgun tests and get lots of labs, troponins, head CTs, and the like. The studies are very clear on this. Head CTs and troponins are very low yield in patients with syncope, and they often do nothing more than cause patients to stay in the ED for longer. One study showed that troponins and head CTs were only positive in 0.5% of patients with syncope, and in all of those patients, there was something in the history of physical exam that suggested the need for a troponin or a head CT. This is why taking a good history is important in these patients. Here's the other thing to know about working on patients with syncope. The older you are, the more workup you require, and the more likely it is that you will need to admit the patient. Young patients with syncope usually get their EKG and HCG and get discharged. Older patients with syncope get labs and usually get admitted. Older patients are at a much higher risk for bad outcomes and will usually require admission for further workup and telemetry monitoring. What we are trying to do is catch an arrhythmia that may have caused the syncope. So let's go through tests that you may want to add to your syncope workup. These are tests that you'll probably add to your older patients who require admission, but not necessarily those with syncope without red flags. First, a D-stick, a CBC, Chem-10, UA, and a non-contrast head CT. So let's go through each one of those and why you may want to order them. So a D-stick, if the patient is diabetic, you'll want to get this. Some people do this on everyone. A CBC is to check for severe anemia that could cause syncope. A Chem-10 can check for electrolyte abnormalities that can cause arrhythmias. A UA can check for UTIs that can cause a wide variety of symptoms, especially in older patients. And finally, if you think the patient suffered head trauma with their syncope, then you'll want to get a non-contrast head CT, plus or minus a CT of the C-spine. Next, let's talk about how to scrutinize the EKG of a patient with syncope. Obviously, we're looking for any usual changes like ST elevation and T-wave inversions, but there are four specific things that we need to look for on every EKG in a patient with syncope. It's most important to look for these four conditions in younger patients with syncope because you don't want to miss an arrhythmia that will kill a young and otherwise healthy patient. This is what we call sudden cardiac death, a young patient who is otherwise very healthy who suddenly dies from an arrhythmia. I'll go through each condition to describe their EKG findings, and I'll post example EKGs on the show notes so you can get a good picture of what these conditions look like. And because I'm posting these EKGs, the show notes are longer than usual, but I think it was worth it to get really good pictures in. First, you'll want to look for a prolonged QT. Long QT syndrome is a congenital arrhythmia where the QT interval is prolonged at baseline. This prolongs the so-called refractory period, and this gives a higher chance that the patient can have a PVC that falls on the downslope of the T wave and cause instant ventricular fibrillation during that vulnerable period in the cardiac cycle. Long QT is defined as a QT longer than 440 milliseconds in males and 460 milliseconds in females. Sometimes the EKG will calculate a long QT when there isn't one. If there is a U wave or other Ditzel after the T wave, the EKG machine will assume that this is part of the T wave and call prolonged QT, even if it's only in one lead. The easiest way to eyeball the QT length is to make sure that the T wave falls in the first half of the R-to-R interval. Most experts say that you need to be most worried about QT intervals longer than 500 milliseconds, but anyone with syncope and a long QT needs follow-up at a minimum. Second, look for signs of Wolff-Parkinson-White, or WPW. WPW represents an accessory tract that can bypass the AV node and cause VTAC. This is seen as a delta wave just before the QRS complex. These patients have a short PR interval and have a slurring of the Q to R transition. Instead of a sharp angle, it's more like a slope from the Q to the R wave. Third, look for signs of Brugada syndrome. This is a sodium channel disorder that causes frequent syncope in young and otherwise healthy patients. In order to make the diagnosis of Brugada, you need to have syncope in the setting of a young, otherwise healthy patient without heart disease who has the following EKG changes: a right bundle branch block pattern with ST elevations in V1 to V3. Fourth and finally, look for hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, or HOCM. This represents a thickened left ventricular wall that can cause outflow obstruction with exercise. Classically, this is a young and healthy athlete who collapses suddenly while playing sports. On the EKG, there are signs of hypertrophy such as large R waves in the lateral leads, or an AVL. The other finding you look for is deep Q waves in the lateral leads, or leads V4 to V6. You can't diagnose LVH based solely on EKG criteria, but any EKG that has signs of LVH should be followed up by a cardiologist. Keep in mind that patients who are young and thin may have impressively tall R waves in V4 to V6 because of their thin chest wall. In this case, lead AVL will be much more specific than the lateral leads. If you have concerns for LVH, especially in a young athlete with syncope during exercise, make sure to refer them for a cardiac echo and tell them not to exercise at all until they are cleared by a cardiologist. I will post the examples of all of these EKGs in the show notes, but realize that EKG interpretation is an art. I will be posting the classic examples of each of these arrhythmias, but sometimes the findings of these arrhythmias will be subtle, so make sure to really scrutinize each EKG in patients with syncope. If you diagnose any of these arrhythmias, then you'll want to talk to your cardiologist to get close follow-up for the patient and possibly admission, depending on the clinical situation. If you're concerned for Brugada syndrome, the safest thing is to immediately admit the patient to a monitored setting so that they can get an implanted defibrillator, because they are at very high risk for sudden cardiac death even without exercise. If you're suspicious for long QT syndrome, in addition to cardiology follow-up and no exercise, I would give the patient seizure precautions such as no driving, no swimming, no dangerous activities, and no showering without someone nearby or a chair in the shower with them to make sure that they don't pass out while doing a dangerous activity. Patients with a concern for HOCM should be told not to exercise until they get an echo and are cleared by a cardiologist. In addition, patients with WPW should get the same instructions not to exercise until they're cleared by a cardiologist. In patients that you are sending home with outpatient cardiology follow-up, stress to them that they cannot exercise whatsoever until the cardiologist says it's okay, or else they can die. Make sure to hammer home this point and make sure that the patient understands the gravity of the situation. Clearly document in the chart that you have reviewed all of these precautions and that the patient understands. Now let's talk about how to disposition patients with syncope. I'll go back to what I said before. In general, young patients with true syncope who have no red flags, a normal EKG, and a negative HCG get discharged. Patients with red flags or symptoms concerning for MI or other serious causes get admitted for further workup. Patients who are older get admitted for telemetry monitoring and further workup, regardless of whether or not they have red flags. Now, what do I mean by older? I don't really have an answer for that one. I would say that anyone over the age of 50 with syncope should possibly be admitted, but this is a moving target. Even the syncope guideline put out by the American College of Emergency Physicians says older patients should be admitted without defining what they mean by older, because each study on syncope uses a different age cutoff when they define older patients. I would say that most EM docs would agree that everyone older than 65 needs admission if they have syncope. Here's one thing to consider. Arrhythmia is the thing that we are most concerned about in regards to syncope. Those older than 50 are at higher risk for heart disease, which is a bigger risk factor for arrhythmia, so patients around this age should probably be admitted, but that's just my take on it. Like I said before, there isn't any agreement on what age patients with syncope should be admitted, so use your judgment on this one. Finally, let me talk for a minute about the San Francisco syncope rule, because I'm sure that you'll hear about it at some point. This is a clinical decision rule that was derived from a group of 384 patients that predicted serious events in patients with syncope with a sensitivity of 92%. In follow-up validation studies, the sensitivity was found to be much lower, sometimes as low as 54%, meaning that the rule missed a large number of patients who went on to have bad outcomes. Here's how you can use the San Francisco syncope rule in your own practice. If the patient is positive for one of the criteria, then it should support your decision to admit the patient, especially if the admitting doctor is giving you a hard time. If the patient is negative for all the criteria, then ignore it. Don't let it sway your decision to admit the patient, because it's just not sensitive enough to predict serious outcomes. Here are the criteria for the San Francisco syncope rule. The mnemonic is CHESS, C-H-E-S-S. It stands for CHF, hematocrit less than 30, EKG abnormalities, shortness of breath, and systolic BP less than 90 after arrival to the ED. So one more time, the mnemonic is CHESS, that's CHF, hematocrit less than 30, EKG abnormalities, shortness of breath, and systolic BP less than 90 after arrival to the ED. So a few clarifications on this. When I say CHF, it means that the patient has a history of CHF or CHF is clinically suspected on presentation. Shortness of breath means a history of shortness of breath with the current episode. And EKG abnormalities excludes minor repolarization abnormalities like T-wave changes. In the original study, the authors defined EKG abnormalities as, quote, non-sinus rhythm or changes from a previous EKG. However, most clinicians that use the rule still consider T-wave changes of any kind to meet the definition of an abnormal EKG. So once again, I only mention the San Francisco syncope rule because you'll hear about it a lot. If the patient is positive for any one of these criteria, it's one more reason to admit the patient. If the rule is negative, then don't let it sway you from admitting the patient. That's all I have on syncope, so let's review some big points. First, syncope is defined as a rapid loss of consciousness followed by a rapid return to baseline. If the patient doesn't meet that definition, then it's not true syncope. Second, all patients with syncope need an EKG, and female patients need an HCG. Further testing is dictated by the clinical situation. Third, syncope with exercise is especially worrisome, and EKGs must be scrutinized for signs of Wolff-Parkinson-White, long QT, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and Brugada syndrome. Finally, in general, young patients with syncope with no red flags go home. Older patients with syncope get admitted for telemetry monitoring and further workup. Don't use the San Francisco syncope rule to rule out the need for admission because it isn't sensitive enough. And that's it for the episode on syncope. As always, leave your comments on the blog at embasic.org or email me at steve@embasic.org. Also follow EM Basic on Twitter under the handle EM Basic. In response to one listener's comment on the blog, for the international listeners out there, I'll make an effort to say generic names for the first time I mention any drugs on the podcast. Stay tuned for a bonus section on how to effectively rehydrate patients in the ED. Until next time, this is Steve Carroll for the EM Basic podcast, signing off. Now it's time for the bonus section. This topic was suggested by a listener, so thanks to Michelle for the suggestion. The question she asked is, how should we rehydrate patients in the ED? She has seen many different approaches to this problem in the ED and was wondering how to best approach it. Here's what you have to consider first. Why is the patient hypovolemic? If the patient is septic, then you need to pour in IV fluids like there's no tomorrow. But for the most common scenario is a patient who is dehydrated from vomiting and or diarrhea. So what are the clinical signs of dehydration? A lot of times we talk about dry tongue or mucous membranes and skin tending, but the most sensitive sign is tachycardia. If the patient has a reason for losing volume like vomiting or diarrhea, and they are tachycardic, then this tells me that they are volume depleted with a few caveats. If the patient is on a beta blocker, they won't mount a tachycardic response to the hypovolemia. Also, I think we're all guilty of thinking that all tachycardia and low blood pressure is due to hypovolemia, and we reflexively bolus IV fluids. There are numerous other causes to tachycardia, like fever, anemia, and arrhythmia, just to name a few. So make sure to think about it before you bolus fluids when you see tachycardia, because not all tachycardia is hypovolemia. So let's say that you have a patient who has vomiting and diarrhea, looks dry, and has some tachycardia. In adults, I'll tend to give these patients 1 or 2 liters of IV normal saline wide open. My endpoint is that they are feeling better and their tachycardia resolves, and that generally lets me know that I'm probably ahead of their fluid losses. If they can handle fluids by mouth with the help of an antiemetic like Zofran, aka Ondansetron, then they can go home. The caution I'll give is that if your patient is older, let's say 60 or so, or has a history of CHF, I don't bolus more than 500 cc's at a time unless they are septic to prevent them from getting volume overloaded. That isn't saying that they can't get more than 500 cc's. Just make sure to reassess them after that bolus and make sure that they aren't short of breath or having crackles that can suggest the onset of heart failure from the fluid that you gave them. You can also drip in the fluids at a slower rate, let's say over an hour instead of the wide open where they're going to get 500 cc's in about 15 to 20 minutes. Now, not all dehydration needs IV fluids. If you have the same patient with vomiting and diarrhea who doesn't look dry on exam and isn't tachycardic, then there's nothing wrong with rehydrating them with PO fluids. Give the patient some Zofran, and 10 to 15 minutes later, give them some water to drink. It would be nice to see them drink about half a liter before they go home, but if they don't look that sick, then I'm okay with a cup or two of water. One other clinical situation to consider is the pregnant patient who is vomiting. In these patients, they form ketones in response to the vomiting, and it's important that we clear these ketones because ketones are not a good fuel source for the developing baby. The way to do this is to give D5 normal saline to give them some sugar to help clear their ketones. Since the liter of D5 has only about 50 calories in it, an even better solution is to give the patient some antiemetics and get them to eat some food which has more calories, which will help them clear their ketones faster. Some people give every patient D5 normal saline because the glucose will help anyone with vomiting feel better faster. Now what about pediatric patients? I'm not a fan of putting an IV in a pediatric patient unless they really need it, so how do we avoid doing this? First, you can give some Zofran. Just don't do this in really young kids, let's say under 3 months old. In this age group, there are a lot of serious causes to vomiting that should be investigated further, so you don't want to give Zofran and cloud the picture. The pediatric dose of Zofran is 0.15 milligrams per kilogram. You can use the ODT version or take the IV version and give it by mouth. A caution that giving the IV version by mouth is probably an off-label use, but it's something that I see frequently in regular practice, just an FYI. The next thing you can do is to start oral rehydration therapy. Some EDs start this protocol on triage in order to rehydrate patients without having to start an IV. The way to do this is to give a syringe to the parent and have them give 1 cc per kilogram of fluid every 5 minutes. So for a 10-kilogram child, this is 10 cc's of fluid every 5 minutes. Usually we use Pedialyte in order to replace electrolytes. For the international listeners, this is probably called oral rehydration solution, and a version of it can be easily made from water, salt, and sugar, and can save lives from dehydration, especially in third world countries. So you'll have the caregiver give 1 cc per kilogram of fluid every 5 minutes. If the patient vomits, then you can pause for about 5 or 10 minutes, but then you should try to restart it as soon as possible. The stopping point is a total of 40 cc's per kilogram of fluid delivered by the parent. Now let's say that you think the patient needs an IV rehydration because PO rehydration isn't working or they look sick. The starting bolus is 20 cc's per kilogram in children, and then you'll want to reassess. You may need as much as 60 cc's per kilogram in septic patients. There are two cautions here. As I said before in the DKA podcast, in pediatric patients with DKA, limit yourself to 1 20 cc per kilogram bolus until you talk with your pediatric endocrinologist to avoid fluid overload and possible cerebral edema. In pediatric hem-onc patients, I've been told to limit fluid boluses to only 10 cc's per kilogram because these kids are at higher risk of heart failure due to the chemotherapy agents that are used in their treatment. So those are my thoughts on rehydration therapy in the ED. Let me know what you think and whether this was helpful. So until next time, this is Steve Carroll for the EM Basic Podcast, signing off.